Blog Talk Radio.
We'd like to welcome you to Missing Pages of History. Missing Pages of History is a program that is dedicated to the upliftment of underserved communities. As always, we will discuss hot topics and current events and news that you can use to enlighten you and make this a better world. All people in all communities. Right now, we have with us one of our analysts and contributors, Emmanuel, on the line. And we also have Susie, who is another contributor, an analyst for Missing Pages of History. And they will be sharing their perspectives on various subjects and topics or information that we believe is vital to our well-being in terms of understanding our world and our communities. Right now, we'd like to welcome Emmanuel to Missing Pages of History. Welcome, Emmanuel.
Welcome. Thank you.
Emmanuel, one of our first topics we'd like to discuss and get your analysis and understanding of it to enlighten our community. One of the recent things that are going on right now in the state of Virginia is this budget crisis as relates to the field of education. When we talk about black universities, it seems like this budget crisis is affecting them greatly. For example, recently Virginia State University has been hit very hard by its lack of enrollment for this year and the budget crisis, and it's created a serious problem in terms of them being able to maybe continue to function as they have been in the past. Just the issue of black schools in general, Emmanuel, is there any way possible that black universities can come out of this web of constantly being dependent on federal money and limiting its potential? Can you explain to our people the whole dynamics of what makes a university and address the issue of black university constantly being in a web of dependency?
I'm trying to get the question asked. Black universities, Virginia, wholly, or black universities across the mainly in the southern region of the United States. But I think that's the question you asked me: the black university, why they're in a budget crisis?
Right.
Well, the big
and
thing.
How do you get out of state of dependency from the federal government, if possible? How does all of this work?
If they work, not the federal government per se, it's tax money that support the university. You also got student loans which come from the government. Again, you have grants, this type of thing. You got tuition. And also you got, of course, the programs of, you know, of, you might say, entertainment, sports. Our universities have to depend on, basically, we don't get major advertisers. We don't get major boosters. We don't get, you know, alumni to contribute X amount of dollars. We get, our grants are not that large. So a lot of things happen here. And again, a lot of kids are spending on student loans. Black universities are expensive to go to. People don't understand how, but they're very costly. They're not that, you know, inexpensive. And a person would rather go to a predominantly white university at the same price, the same cost, as they go to a black university. The resources at black universities, again, are not as prevalent as they are at basically predominantly white universities. And again, the enrollment, the student population, the infrastructure, a lot of these things depend on it. And it takes money to do this. And, of course, the professors and the curriculum, they get paid professors X amount of dollars. The professors at black universities make us half as much as the average at predominantly white universities. And most of them, when they get their PhDs, if they try to apply at a white university, become a professor, associate professor. Most of the associate professors, assistant professors at white universities make more than full-time at black universities. So that's a lot involved. The money that we get, President Obama, I think, a couple of years ago or last year, I think he, on an executive order, $198 million. That's more than they ever got. But that's as far as he can go with executive order. The purse string has to come. The purse strings are held by the House of Representatives, which is banks of Republicans, and they're not giving it up. They want to mesh you into their universities because mainly what they don't want so much of our scholars. They want our athletes to make them what they are. And then when the athletes come, of course, they're going to come with white coaches, white assistant coaches, maybe one black coach out of about 8 or 10. So it creates jobs for them, high-paying jobs for them. And, of course, the university athletes make them what they are. Of course, donate making the millions of dollars. The black coach is not going to be, I think we got less than 5 or 6 black coaches on these 3,000 schools we got, making money, huge money, making. So the big thing is to use our black athletes again to make their money. And this is what this is all about, to strip our universities and our high schools from our, you know, with the, you might say, elite black athletes go to predominantly white schools. The second, third, and fourth string go to basically black universities. Now, when one time when you couldn't go there, like University of Alabama, you couldn't even go there and didn't want a black athlete there. But look how much money they're making now with the black athlete and the coach, everybody is making bungs of money and advertising just going their way. So you look at that. We don't have that type of prominence. We don't have that in the black universities. And this is what the kids are being told and being seen. And the consultants at the schools, the counselors, they might call them. I call them consultants. But the counselors, what they're saying, you don't need to, you know, the high school, go to that school. You get a better education at a Vanderbilt. You get a better education at a Georgia Tech or a Georgia. You get a better education, better this, better that. And, of course, you got boosters clubs that help them also. So athletics play a huge part of the university. But most of our schools are based on mainly social sciences. And that's why education, you know, boils around. Very few black law schools and black universities. I think it's about 3 or 4 at the most. Very few medical schools. So you want to be a doctor and a lawyer, don't even need hardly go there for that. You know, less expensive going to North Carolina Central than going to Harvard, or, you know, in the big time or Duke and law school. So you got to get, you know, student loans to even do that. But you're paying back student loans the rest of your life. When the white schools are offering, like my niece can offer, 4 paid scholarships, you're going to be a doctor, John Hopkins. Don't have to pay a dime. Whoa, not one nickel. And Duke offering the same thing. Don't have to pay one nickel. And you get a PhD, get initials behind her name, MD and PhD. So it's all paid for. See? So again, very few of us from black universities will get this type of, you know, prominence. And they look for them. And they want them to say, well, we have some equal opportunity, affirmative action, some they had for 500 years, affirmative action. But we don't know nothing about affirmative action. So again, it's an institute that's been around for 500 years, affirmative action has. But they look at it like, huh, we don't know, you know what it is. Like I said, I think we don't know what it is. But that's what's going on with our black institutions. The federal government, taxpayers' money, grants coming from corporations, we don't get enough of those. And we don't get enough per student of where we are predominantly. So we look at all those numbers. And that is what's going on. We got 106, 105 black colleges left. We have 181. So they're leaving very fast. Some are integrating with some of the larger, you know, predominantly white universities because they have the resources. And again, credentials are much, much higher. When you go get a job, you say, I come out of MIT for engineering, or Georgia Tech, or Purdue, it carries more weight than Zach went to A&T. Or I went to, you know, Hampton, or I went to, you know, Virginia Union. It carries more weight, way more weight. I used to hire engineers, so I know what I'm talking about. It just carries more weight. They get paid more and everything else. So you try to, you know, you try to make a number at your job, equal opportunity, affirmative action, all this. You got to have so many because of the demographics. Well, this is what happens. It's all the number game. It's all the number game in capitalism, along with racism. You're going to have this. We got to endure this. And we got to attack the blueprint of racism and capitalism.
Okay. One of the questions I'd like to just raise with you in terms of when we discuss the issue of black universities and coming out of the state of dependency or being more independent, you know, we have a large alumni. They have large, well-established alumni. Many people believe that if they could organize their alumni, that they could have a financial base in which it could at least greatly improve their less dependency on federal dollars. How would you respond to that rationale?
Very poorly, because, again, the job they leave in black universities are not that great of a job. You got about 1% or 2% might get a job that pays over six figures. The rest of them just don't have the extra money. Got a family, trying to buy a home, got a car, get a job. You know, they may be paying for babysitting or daycare service. It's just not there. The money is not there. When you leave a predominantly white college, you're going to make more money. That's why they have what they have. The colleges, the white colleges depend on, you know, federal government money too, but they get much more. And the alumni is much, 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 much bigger. You're talking about 30, 40,000 students. You're not talking about 3, 4,000 students. Understand the number game. You're talking about a school that has 20, 30, 40,000, almost 60% of the universities are predominantly white, have these type of student enrollment. 30 and 40,000, not 3 or 4,000, or 6 or 7,000. There are huge stadiums that are just humongous, hold 50, 60, 70, 100,000, some of them hold, like Michigan, Ohio, 100,000 people in the state stands. What stadiums do black universities have? How many do they hold? Some have to play at other schools. The advertising package is just not there. They're not on ABC and NBC and all that stuff. They're not there. They do it once in a while on a courtesy thing. You can't go to another school and get $1 million for playing. It doesn't work. It would not greatly improve anything because they just don't have the money. Alumni graduate from the predominantly black university just don't have the money. They just don't have it. They can't give up the type of grants and that grants in their name and everything else. Our biggest grant givers I know are basically three people that give in the millions: Bill Cosby, Oprah Winfrey, and Willie Gary. How much do the rest of them give? We see the Negro College Fund. You see all these things. Now you don't see the Holly anymore. You never see on there any, you know, white college fund. It doesn't happen. Don't have to happen. We're not in the begging mode. We're not in that mode. That's the mode we're in. But they're not in that mode. Because the alumni, everybody gets paid there. At the white, you know, predominantly white university. They get paid. A lot of money. The Harvard, the Yale, the Princeton, the Rutgers, the Boston, this is money. Stanford, this is money. These universities are huge. And I'll make one statement to show you how to do a comparison. Ohio State, Michigan, Notre Dame, you can name Texas A&M, Texas. Their athletic budget is more than $50 million per school. Alabama, all of them. All the black schools' athletic budget put together don't come to $50 million. This is what we're talking about. That's just an amazing number. Ohio State University, the Michigan, the Notre Dame, I can name them all. UCLA, USC, Alabama, Texas, I can name them all, basically. The athletic budget is more than $50 million. Comparison, all of the 100 black schools you got that have athletic programs, all the whatever they do, intramural sports, everything they do, don't come to $50 million, all the black schools together. And the coaches don't, their coaches average $175,000 compared to over $1.5 million for white universities that has coaches. No comparison. The basketball, same thing. Basketball, even less. average black basketball coach makes 125 grand in black schools. It's a different ball game. So the game, the numbers just are just astronomical. Astronomical numbers. If each black person, just to give you another number, black 35,000 black millionaires in this country worth assets of $4 million. I'm with, you know, then put that in cash, but they're millionaires on assets, everything else. 35,000. They got more millionaires in New York, in the state of New York, and our population is 43 million than all the black millionaires put together. 10 times as many in New York City alone. This was kind of numbers we're talking about. Just the money. When one is worth $135,000 and one is worth less than $6,000 when they die. No, we can't do a whole lot of that. But everybody's scrapping for money to black universities. You put money in the black universities, alumni come back and give $100,000 apiece, whatever they want to give. Where is the money going? The money going to try to go in the professor's pocket, the teacher's pockets. It's going. How much is going to infrastructure? How much is going where it's supposed to go? Everybody's scrapping for money. They read the same thing I'm reading, basically. That they make, they're making less than the, you know, the white professors, predominantly college, make less than half. They make, you know, less than $100,000 a year, and they make, you know, $170,000 a year. They read all that. So if you put money there, where is it going? Where is it going to better? They want to get paid first. Are they leaving? You want to try to keep them there. So the money going straight to the professor in their pockets where they need the administration's pocket, like everything else does. It's like the lottery, 85% administration. Not going to education. Should be the other way around. Every time money is created, believe me, white people try to find a way to take the money any way they can. And I can tell you all the ways they take it too. They have a, they have what they call a safety net. They have a fantastic safety net.
Okay, we'd like to let listen. Want to just know that y'all listen to Missing Pages of History. We're basically having some hot topics that we are discussing today. One of them we're talking about. Black universities or African universities and the state of dependency. Recently, there have been some discussion in the state of Virginia about one of the historically black universities, Virginia State University, and the impact of the budget crunch and the loss of student enrollment and how it's having an impact on that universities. And this is a story that has been seen throughout the country when you talk about historical African schools or black schools. We do have with us one of the analysts, Susie, out of Virginia. Sister Susie, welcome to Mr. Page of History. What have you heard or read about what's going on at Virginia State and this crisis that's going on at this university? What is your perspective on that?
One of the reasons they got a $19 million cut is the fact that the governor cut the budget for all state universities here, in which on top of Virginia State losing students by the governor cutting their budget for the state universities, that has affected them greatly. They had to end up closing up some programs and stuff to try to accommodate and make other issues work out with the school within their budget.
Okay, with our listening audience again, we'd like to remind folks that we will have our phone lines open now at 818-337-0016, 818-337-0016. Call in if you have any hot topics or comments you'd like to make as we discuss these issues and others, or you can go to our chat line. Our Mr. Page of History chat line is open. We welcome you. So right now, what we're going to do at this point in time, Emmanuel, we can come back to you, then we can open up our phone lines. One other hot topic or issue that has taken place this week is the resignation of Eric. It is the resignation of our top Attorney General, Eric Holton. And in terms of its resignation, Emmanuel, we recognize he had a lot of things on his plate. He had a lot of key issues that the federal government was investigating, such as the Michael Brown incident in Ferguson, the Tyrone Munn incident in Stanford, Florida. We're looking at this question of racial profiling as it relates to certain police and law enforcement agencies. And that was a lot on the plate that he was attempting to tackle. And since he is resigning, what is your understanding of its impact? And one of the questions that people ask is, why now? Why is he resigning now? So what is your views and perspective on the resignation of Eric Holton at this time, Emmanuel?
Well, first of all, most of them don't even serve a term. He won the longest, one of the longest terms of attorney. One thing over. Again, you got the music ago. One thing that cites him over other attorney generals that he was the people's lawyer. Well, attorney general, you don't find him as a people's lawyer. Because he got involved in civil rights. He got involved, of course, gay rights, voting rights. He got involved in things that most attorney generals, and being the top cop, things that you should get involved in. But they weren't used to this, special voting rights. This was something that they weren't used to. Attorney general going to a state, again, himself opposed to sending someone to Ferguson, Missouri. President Obama said, send someone down there. He went himself. That's why I call him the people's lawyer. He's probably the best attorney general we ever had. Because, again, that's why I call him the people's lawyer, things that he did. He puts his job on the line for a lot of things. And, again, Congress didn't like some of the things that he did because he talked back to him. He's a top law enforcement officer. He was doing his job. They don't like you to do their job when you're upsetting their power. The power. Who are you, a black attorney general, to upset our power, to make things a little bit difficult for us? Things that we've been doing all the time, see, we do it all the time. And you ain't got no business putting your nose into this. Well, he being a black person, he knew the ills and know the takes of what it takes to be a law enforcement officer. And again, he's a top law enforcement officer. Well, again, they don't like that. And they, being the white establishment, they want you to stay in your place. Well, we got to keep them in their place, which is the law. They're not above the law. See, some people think they're above the law. Advanced Europeans think they're above the law. They've been doing it. They've been lawless for the longest. And he sort of puts them, everything I'm doing is to the law. And they don't like it. They try to impeach him. They try to contempt of court on him. First time ever happened. But he made a statement. He said, now forget it. He said, I am the Attorney General of the United States, but I'm a black man. Because he knew the lawlessness of the court system of this country. It says never change and will not change unless a person like this is on top. What makes him what he is? When he went to the prison system and basically reduced the sentence of 200,000 prison inmates. 200,000. That's the first reduction in decades of the prison system because of drugs. You're not locking up the guy who's bringing the drugs up in here. You're getting the one that's pushing them on the street, basically, and giving them 15 and 20 years. Didn't make any sense to me. Very few people own our planes, own boats. We know who owns the boats and our planes. We know who's doing this. But again, don't you get involved with this too much. So he's basically changed some of the sentencing, the mandatory minimum sentencing, policy that results in long prison terms. That's one of the greatest things I think he did for nonviolent offenders. And I thought that was, he sort of streamlined the rules. And that was a great thing to do. Because, again, you're getting labor-free again in the prison system. That's what they do. That's why they do what they do. Understand the blueprint of capitalism. The blueprint goes way beyond what we'd be talking about. The blueprint is way beyond that. He can make it better, I think, as a lawyer out in the field. I think he's tired of butting heads with Republicans in Congress. You get tired of certain things. They want to make sure that he prioritized law enforcement over partisan concerns. Well, because he's Obama's friend, they think everything is partisan. No. Voting rights is not partisan. Everybody's supposed to have a right to vote. And that's all he said. Anybody got a problem with that? They partisan. But racism is in Congress, like it's very rampant in Congress. I think some Klan members are there. They look like Klan members in suits. But nobody wanted to confront them. They say everything they want to say about Mr. Holder, what he was, who he is, and everything. Third in his class at Yale University Law School. The guy is brilliant, and they're not. And he showed them their fault. You wrote the law, and I'm going to tell you a law. And that's what he does. He tears their law apart, and what they're doing is totally wrong. And they don't like it. Because they're not in power anymore. They get through President Obama through him. Because that's his friend. That's his buddy. And they will scrutinize the next one he appoints to make sure that they do certain things. When he went to get the people on Wall Street and put them in jail, they didn't like it. Because that's the Republicans' base, where they get their money from. Oh, you're not going to put our guys in jail. Well, he did the alternative thing. He basically fined them. That's all he could do. It would cost too much to try to do anything with these guys from Wall Street. They're using other people's money to finance their wrongdoing. And
okay,
that's what it's all
about. Okay, let me just stop you right there. We'll take a couple phone calls. Also, we'd like to have a listening audience who is on the website to our chat line, and they may want to go to call in at 818-337-0016. We can go over for a few more minutes, and you can hear the entirety of the show or go to our archive at blogtalkradio.com/missing-pages-of-history-inc. So we can go to our caller 3330. Your question or comment, please. Welcome to Missing Pages.
Thanks for having me. I'd like to make a comment in regards to what Sister Robinson was stating about Virginia State University. I have a cousin that's currently attending there in his sophomore year, and they're in such dire straits there that you have professors that are basically working off of a promissory note, because I was informed by my cousin's mother that if these professors don't receive some type of compensation within coming days, they're just going to abruptly leave the university, and basically that class will be canceled, but yet the students will still be held accountable for their debt, even though it's nothing they did. So clearly there's a lot of ineptitude in regards to the administration, and it only makes you wonder what's going to happen when you look at what happened with St. Paul's. The ineptitude got to a fever pitch to the point now the school is just a figment of what it once was, and, you know, it's up for grabs as people try to put their bids in to, you know, do something with that property.
Okay, caller, we'd like to thank you for your support and listening to Mrs. Pages in History. We're going to try one other caller who's been waiting patiently. Caller, your last four numbers, 8488. Caller, 8488. Any comment or question, please? Caller, 8488. Okay, we're going to call 8488. We'll come back. But Mr. Joyner and Susie, y'all hear what the caller just said about the Virginia J situation? Any particular response to that?
Yeah, I've seen that happen before. Promissory notes that put the university, but like I said before, it's the base. They want the university to digress themselves into the basically, you know, the white institutions. And the way to do it is cut off the stream of money. And that's why President Obama did what he did. $198 million he gave to black university without the congressional approval from the House of Representatives, who hold the purse strings. They don't want to allocate the money. And he did that on his own. They didn't like that. They go, now they'll sustain it longer than they're supposed to, than they should sustain. Because he did what he did. $190 million is nothing. But it was more than they'd have had. But like I said again, there's nothing. They're on a mission to do this. Underneath that mission, they're saying we want to not destroy black universities, but only a few of them going to be left standing. And this is what they put. Again, they're pulling from our university, pulling our professors. They put in quite a few people from there. Because they get X amount of dollars, too. See, if their staff is not, is not according to demographics. The white university, they have to, they get a lot of money. And you're not going to cut their money off. So they're going to have black professors. They're going to make sure the school has what they need according to the demographics of that particular state or that particular city that it's in. And these are new rules that's coming in, especially down the southern schools from Maryland on down. Mason-Dixon line, this is what the rules they're putting in underneath in the state legislature. This is what they're doing. And for them to get federal money, they have to abide to the affirmative action. But some of these schools have, you got to hire some professors where the population is in that particular, where they are in that county, it's like, 6%, 8% black population. They got 8% people have to be on the board and have to be, professors there or in some type of, some type of job opportunity there for them. They have to be employed as such. And I ran that same thing when I was, in aerospace, the same thing. I had to hire accordingly to L.A. They moved a place out to the county where it was like 4% African-American, and we only hired 4%. In the county of L.A., in L.A., you had to hire at least 19%. So, of course, you had more African-Americans up there. And the jobs you give them had to be based from menial jobs, from domestic engineering up. But I had to go out and get engineers. And they said, well, we need some black engineers. Can you find them? I said, how many do you want? How can I find them? How many do you want? See, so they have all, they got this, they're wide different. White people are wide different than we are because we came in chains. They didn't come in chains. Understand the dynamics how we got here. And slavery for 100 years. Understand the dynamics. Discrimination, apartheid, Jim Crow, new Jim Crow. Understand racism is part of capitalism. We have to understand that. And they have different, they have all kind of institutes out here, think tanks, that institute this type of stuff. They do it a certain way. And they had to do it, again, like in Virginia, the governor, whoever it was, cut the budget off and go into the schools. They're doing the same here in North Carolina. It's the same thing, allocating less money. Because they want you to go to Duke. They want you to go to Oklahoma State. They want you to go to Carolina. They want that money you're getting from the government, student loan, to come to them. To come to them, not to that university. So, they're going to starve them out, paying professors less, no raise, no this, no that. It's going to be so many no's on your table. Like I said, one no is a promissory note. First two letters are no. Promise, no. That promise not going to come out. So they're going to walk away. They got to eat. Understand the dynamics of how capitalism works along with racism. They're side by side. They're in the same bowl. Just like milk and cereal.
Point is granted. And also, I think part of this issue of education is that there are certain leading institutions that really play a major role in shaping the ideals of people, and they would teach the people what's in the best interest for the rich and the most powerful. So a question of education is also a question of what type of education we're talking about receiving when we go to these various institutions.
You're receiving capitalism education.
Exactly.
You're receiving racism education, what you're going to receive to sustain. and that's the only escape you're going to get. But again, you got to put a sifter out there and say, how much is this for me and how much is not for me? Well, you got to live. How much of survival I have to deal with this? And the other ones you don't deal with. I don't deal with the drinking. I ain't buying their liquor. I'm not buying their smokes. I don't buy smoking. Little of their clothes as possible. I buy little as possible. Again, to support. But we don't have the thing to support. They're not going to let you have that. We own 2% of the businesses in America, United States of America. 2%. They control the food, the shelter, and the clothing. They control where you stay. But they control where you get your groceries from. They control what you wear. They give you crumbs. They only give you 10% or less. That's all you're going to get. That's it. That's all you're going to get. It's never going to be turned around where they get, if you get 90% and they're going to get 10%. That ain't going to ever happen.
You know, one point of observation, and we were talking a little bit about what the resignation of Eric Holden may mean to many issues that are taking place right now around this country. And I recently read an article where the Justice Department contacted the state police force in Ferguson, Missouri, and asked them to stop wearing little wristbands in support of Donald Wilson, the policeman who shot Michael Brown. They told him to stop wearing it because they feel like it alienated people. I just wonder, when you have policemen sending out those kind of signals in terms of supporting something they feel like that was justifiable, while at the same time the people they're supposed to serve were totally against it, what kind of signals does them by the police force wearing these bracelets on their arms, on their wrists, what kind of signal does that send to the public in terms of them being some kind of a servant that's really there for the people? How do you view that, Emmanuel? And I would like you to just put that to the listening audience. What does that really, what does that mean when they wear bracelets in support of the policeman who shot Michael Brown?
Well, what happened is that they're united, and, of course, most police departments are united regardless. That image, that pictorial image that people can see again, you're still in a southern state. You still got southern ideas. You still got racism, everything else. They tell you from John Street when you had 53 police officers and 50 of them are white in a predominantly black town, that should tell you something. They already sent you, they already sent you a pictorial of what's happening. Very divisive. And it's very split, and it's very racist. And they understand, you're going to understand. They're trying to picture that to you. That's what they're all about. Because they say, well, you can wear your T-shirts, you can wear your neckties with, you know, with Brown's name on it. You can do what you want. I'm going to demonstrate the same way, pictorially. Our police department going to be standing firm with Mr. Wilson. We're standing firm with him. Most police department, that's why Eric Holder got 50 on investigation, being scrutinized for what they do, misconduct. Most police departments are in this misconduct mode and misappropriation mode because that is their one of their safety nets. That's how they strip the money out of the towns, strip the money out of the cities, like Detroit and Chicago. They stripped the money out because they were in charge with a racist police department, mainly all whites. For 30 years, they retire. They take the money out. It's a nepotism job. Their brother, their cousin, all of them become police officers. That's the first only application is nepotism. Don't put it on there, but that's what it is. You ask him how he get high, what qualification? Got none. Don't need none. First application is pigmentation. That's the first that's the first thing on the application. No pigmentation. Controlling what you're stealing. They police what they steal and make sure you don't steal and get policed the same way. You do what they do, you get longer time. You get 7.5 years longer sentence for the same thing that, you know, that the whites do. They don't want to educate you. They don't want to do that at all, basically. It's just a must at the moment. They have to, you can go to school. That's a must. They got private schools, charter schools. Everything is not to educate you. They want to imprison you. They want to imprison you. And Eric Holder stepped across the line when he basically going into police departments and scrutinizing them and their misconduct. They don't like that. See, my last statement to make on Attorney General Holder is that some attorney generals wait for history. Others make history. The attorney general we got, he's making history. This ain't something never been done before. You go into a town of Ferguson, that small, not New York, not L.A., not Chicago, not Washington, D.C., not Miami, but go into a small city of 22,000 people, the attorney general goes there and say you've done some wrongdoing. That is, according to the Republicans, that's divisive. The federal government overstepping their bounds. And like, again, you know, the whole thing is that investigating police conduct, they don't like that because now you protecting the people that's, you know, you invading something, how they got what they got by stealing. They stole the country, they stole everything. And say, you know, they use all these words from squatters to settlers, all these terms they don't use to take somebody else's stuff. But when you do the same thing, that's a problem. Their blueprint is to take. And I said it before, I said it again. They made the Ten Commandments, basically. The Ten Commandments said, thou shalt not steal. That's all they do. They said, thou shalt not kill. That's all they do. They shall not commit adultery. That's all they do. So everything the Ten Commandments say, that's what they do. And they police that. They police that and make sure that you don't do that. And when you do it, wow. Look what you do when you do any kind of misappropriation of funds, and you're a governor, you're a mayor. If you're a black mayor, you get 10 years, 20 years, 25 years, and the white mayor, might make a movie about it. He's going to get paid, try to throw it out of court. Whatever they're going to try to do, they try to do it. Because they put their judges in the case, they do crazy stuff. But like I said again, that is what this is all about. You got to put the two together. Racism and capitalism.
Hello? Hello? We have some technical difficulties. The line has been cut off. We have some difficulties that are beyond our control. We'd like to thank everybody for listening to Missing Pages of History. Stay tuned every other Saturday at 12 noon as we continue to fill in our missing pages of history. Thank you. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, we're being cut off. We have some technical difficulties. We apologize to the audience. It was beyond our control. We only have a minute left. We basically like to thank everyone today for their participation to Missing Pages of History. And we come on a biweekly basis at 12 noon. And if you want more information, feel free to contact us, MissingPagesofHistory1@yahoo.com, or you can call us at 804-726-3217. And we have a next upcoming quarterly raffle drawing on November 15. We encourage you to come and support us. All contributions are welcome, and you can send it to P.O. Box 4433, Richmond, Virginia, 23220. Until next time, let's continue to fill in our missing pages of history and move forward. We thank you.